Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. What does a river's legacy mean for future development? Like back in 2014 in West Virginia, when thousands of people were without drinking water for days because of a chemical spill.
The impact was so great because the drinking water system got contaminated.
Across Appalachia, there have been other isolated incidents, just like the Elk River chemical spill. Last year, people in Wheeling, West Virginia, looked at the Ohio River and saw a very unsettling sight.
The river, it started looking kind of like a neon slime across the top of the river. It was kind of eerie, in a way, to have the river alive like that.
So can a river with a dirty past still be used for development? Some in the Ohio Valley are banking on it.
Maybe I'm not that smart, but what I am is I believe in the future of this area.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. It's easy to take the water coming out of your faucet for granted, but tragedies like the Elk River chemical spill that left thousands of residents in West Virginia's capital city without water for days have put tap water front and center. Appalachia is no stranger to water contamination, especially in places with the history of heavy industry like the Ohio Valley. But as a large source of drinking water, how do we know it's safe? Reporters and producers at West Virginia Public Broadcasting teamed up with the Allegheny Front to take a closer look at what's going on along the banks of the mighty Ohio in a series called Headwaters. I invited Kathy Naur, executive producer of the Allegheny Front, to talk about the series of reports. So what inspired this project?
Well, it's really that question of, you know, what is the vision for this river watershed? You know, it's a massive watershed throughout most of western Pennsylvania, of course, West Virginia, and down through. And, you know, there seems to be no kind of regional vision, goals set for this watershed. And so we wanted to take a look at what's the current status and current issues around water quality in the watershed, and what could it be? You know, looking at recreational opportunities, looking at drinking water, source water protection. So it's came out of conversations we had over the summer, and thought it'd be great to pull in West Virginia Public Broadcasting as a partner and do more of a regional approach to this question.
The Ohio River is the most polluted river in the country, and on the Allegheny Front's website it says the working river legacy of the Ohio has made it this way. So what's going on along the banks?
Well, it's still a very industrial river, especially down through the Ohio Valley. And there's still a lot of, you know, big discharges of industrial wastewater. It's regulated, of course, but it's still, having a lot of pollution discharges to it, as well as a lot of legacy pollution that's left over from previous industries that's in the river. It's not going anywhere, things like PCBs and mercury. You know, so it does have a lot of industrial pollution. It has combined sewer overflows here in the Pittsburgh region and elsewhere. So there's a lot of pollution issues that still need to be addressed.
How can a river be the most polluted in the country but still supply drinking water to so many people?
Well, you know, drinking water treatment plants have been doing a good job looking at their, looking at their violations along the river. We've not seen any, you know, major problems. It seems to be that there is strong drinking water treatment. The Orsenco, which is the Ohio Valley Sanitation Commission, which is looking at a multi-state approach to water quality, and you know they have a pretty robust source water protection and monitoring, so they know what's in the river and can, you know, warn treatment plants when there's a problem, when there's a spill. So I think it's a testament to that kind of system that has made the drinking water, up to snuff.
We're talking a lot about industry and its effects on the environment, it seems, in this series, or at least part of it. How is the economy and the state of the economy, the needs of the economy, or just that whole part of the conversation, how is it addressed in these reports?
Well, those kind of issues will be addressed when we look at recreation versus industrial development along the riverfronts. I think that, you know, here in Pennsylvania, there's a lot of excitement around the economic development potential that is focused on this Shell ethane cracker that is going to be built in a few years here. It'll take a few years to build, but a multi-billion dollar ethane cracker that will take the natural gas from this region and, you know, produce the building blocks of plastic. And there's a hope that there will be an industrial renaissance around petrochemicals, not only in Pennsylvania, but down the Ohio. And but that needs to be balanced, you know, with what is the potential for recreation? That's also, you know, a multi-billion dollar industry in this country. So, you know, we look at the barge industry as well, looking at infrastructure issues of locks and dams along the rivers. They're not being upgraded as they need to be for how the barge industry is changing, and is that going to impact the ability to move chemicals and other products up and down the river.
And what do you hope the biggest takeaway is from this series?
I think that the takeaway is that, you know, water, of course, is something that's extremely important to this region. It's something that should be managed and looked at as a resource on a, you know, multi-state level. It's not state by state, river watershed by river watershed, but just, you know, it's important to look at this as a whole.
Kathy, thanks so much for your time.
Sure. You're welcome.
Kathy Naur is with the Allegheny Front, which partnered with us to produce today's show. The Ohio River, which flows from Appalachia into the Mississippi, has been labeled the most polluted river in the country. But how does that work? Just because the river carries a significant load of chemicals doesn't necessarily mean it's more polluted than any other source of drinking water. Ann Lee reports all the problems might actually be helping to make drinking water safer. Kind of.
So you wake up every morning, and chances are one of the first things you do is turn on the faucet. More than 3 million people in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and West Virginia get that tap water from the Ohio River. And according to the Environmental Protection Agency, the Ohio is also one of the most polluted rivers in the country. Remember hearing newscasts like this one a few years ago?
This morning, more than 300,000 West Virginians are scrambling for water after a toxic chemical spill contaminated the main water supply in 9 counties across Charleston.
So here's what happened. In 2014, 10,000 gallons of a coal processing chemical leaked into the Elk River from a storage tank owned by Freedom Industries. And it was just upstream from a water treatment plant, where Charleston pulls in water from the river to send to its customers.
Right now, so many people scrambling for water after residents were warned away from using tap water for anything.
Evan Hansen is head of an environmental consulting group in Morgantown, West Virginia. And when he saw what was happening, he got to work.
I started just doing some online research into source water protection and some of the policies that were related to that, and just started tweeting out some information that I started to find.
He gathered enough information to write a report about it, and West Virginia lawmakers quickly noticed.
The impact was so great because the drinking water system got contaminated. So systems were not in place or actions were not taken to prevent that contamination from happening.
So this spill, which is in a part of West Virginia known as Chemical Valley, got the whole state to get serious about protecting its drinking water supply from chemical spills. West Virginia increased regulation of chemical storage tanks, and it required water treatment plants to spell out how they would protect their source water. That's the water we drink and use in our homes. Other states along the Ohio River, like Pennsylvania and Ohio, have been taking these kinds of steps for years.
The Ohio River has been in front of any water system in this country and probably around the world.
That's Stanley States. He worked at the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority for more than 30 years. He now educates experts at water treatment plants around the country on how to protect drinking water from chemical spills and other environmental problems. And when he says the river in states like Pennsylvania is better regulated, it's not necessarily because they had so much foresight. Nope, it was because they had spills of their own.
Because you have to justify the expense. Unfortunately, they have to wait usually for definitive proof that this is really a threat before you can justify putting huge sums of money in.
Another benefit of unexpected contamination in the river, if you can even call it that, is improved water monitoring. Richard Harrison is the head of the Ohio River Valley Water Sanitation Commission, called ORSANCO. They get about 600 calls a year about spills into the river.
Some are a cup of material.
But when it's a bigger spill, Orsenko works with the water utilities to assess what should be done.
And really help determine if it's something that the downstream utilities need to be concerned about.
So as the Elk River spill made its way down to the Ohio River, water utilities were in communication. By the time the contamination reached Cincinnati, they already knew what time to expect it and how long to shut down their water intakes.
And then we were able to work with the Greater Cincinnati Water Works to then convey that same information downstream to Louisville and Evansville.
Now, you might also expect that treatment plants continuously test the raw water coming into their plants. And they do in some cities like Pittsburgh. Charleston was required to do it after the Elk River spill. But that's actually a new idea in many places. Some treatment plants just don't have the resources for that kind of technology. That's where new technology can help. We're in Highland Park in Pittsburgh. Today sparkles with blue skies, crisp air, and ducks flying over a small pond. At age 26, Christopher Tomaszewski looks a little old to be playing with a toy boat. He's holding a computer tablet and controlling a meter-long boat in the water. He's actually a PhD student at Carnegie Mellon University.
And I work at Platypus, which is an environmental monitoring company. We use robots like this to survey areas for depth or pollution.
It's kind of like a drone in the water. It uses a cell phone's compass and GPS systems to navigate around. Platypus has been used to collect water quality data near wastewater treatment plants for information about salinity and dissolved oxygen,
which is critical for like plant life and fish.
He says the data and water samples collected by this little boat can get a more comprehensive look at what's happening in the water than researchers could ever get before. And that's just one way technology is being used. As inexpensive projects like Platypus improve data gathering, others are now sharing that information online and in real time. The idea is to keep giving water treatment plants more information and more notice so they can handle what's coming down the river and protect their sources of drinking water.
That was West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Ann Lee reporting. The Elk River chemical spill that Ann mentioned also brought on an investigation by the Kanawha County Public Service Commission. Part of the case was settled. In the settlement, West Virginia American Water committed to install better chemical monitoring equipment at its intake and give advanced warning of a spill, among other things. The settlement was meant to better protect the drinking water supply. Several communities are still wrestling with the contamination left by a toxic chemical called C8. The chemical, used in nonstick surfaces like Teflon and is found in flame retardants, sticks around in the environment. For the Allegheny Front's Headwater series, Glennis Board visited the community where cleanup is costing millions. But some researchers say public health may still be at risk.
This summer, cars lined up in Vienna, West Virginia. People were picking up jugs and cases of bottled water. Their tap water had been deemed unsafe, laced with a chemical known as C8.
Yeah, what do they want? Bottles. Where at? Back? Front?
There wasn't some sudden chemical spill. The chemical company DuPont polluted the water here for decades. But the federal government says C8 levels it once allowed in the water are now considered unsafe.
Up until the EPA lowered the standard, it really wasn't an issue for us. Once they lowered the standard, then it became a problem.
That's Vienna Mayor Randy Rapp. He's talking about a new health advisory issued by the Environmental Protection Agency this year. It said C8 levels in his and other communities' drinking water are too high.
Back door.
People we spoke with in line have known about DuPont's C8 contamination for years, but they need the chemical company. For generations, it's been the biggest employer around Vienna. Many people, like resident Charles Swisher, are quick to defend them.
It's not fair to isolate DuPont, you know, as there's a lot of people doing things back a few years ago that you know, were unethical, unhealthy. The thing that we need to do now is to be more solution-oriented. We can't go back and change, you know, what has happened.
DuPont is not in charge of those solutions. It created a spin-off company, Chemours, which inherited this environmental legacy. In response to the EPA C8 advisory, Chemours is paying for installation, maintenance, and monitoring of giant carbon filters to clean drinking water. Think your Brita water filter, but on a huge scale. Vienna Mayor Randy Rapp says he has no idea how much cleanup is costing. Chemours wouldn't say, but According to the company's public documents, cleanup has already cost millions, and still, the water aquifer is expected to be contaminated with C8 for hundreds of years. Not everyone is defending the company. Larry Dale grew up around this part of the Ohio River, which is commonly referred to as Chemical Valley. His father and his uncles all worked in chemical plants.
My dad told me, and I'll never forget this, find something else to do, but don't work in a chemical plant.
Dale listened. He's a school bus driver and a retired preacher, but he and his family still live in the shadow of the chemical industry.
You're on the north side of my property.
Okay. Dale stands on top of a hill next to his greenhouse and points to the next ridge over, at DuPont's landfill.
We're actually looking at a northeasterly direction. The landfill itself is that way.
This is where the company dumped over 7,000 tons of C8 sludge. It polluted streams and killed nearby livestock in the late 1990s. Concern over the contamination eventually led to a broad medical study of more than 30,000 community members, including Dale and his family.
My wife tested highest.
He doesn't blame the nearby landfill. He blames the tap water.
It's going to be with me till the day I die. It doesn't just go away.
The study of residents in this area linked C8 to a bunch of health problems, from cancer to reduced immune function. A series of additional health studies followed and further proved that chemical compounds like C8, which were buried in landfills, dumped into waterways, and blown out of smokestacks and scattered across the Ohio Valley for years, well, these chemicals are dangerous, even in small doses.
They stay in the body for a very, very long time.
Dr. Philippe Grandjean of Harvard School of Public Health is an expert on the health effects of perfluorinated chemicals like C8. His latest study looks at the long-term health effects of these chemicals on the immune system of exposed children.
If they harm the immune system today, they probably also will, you know, several years down the road. And that's exactly what we found.
Specifically, Grandjean found vaccines don't work as well in children exposed to C8 at levels similar to those found throughout the U.S. EPA officials say the C8 advisory levels were calculated to protect fetuses during pregnancy and breastfed infants, and based on the best available peer-reviewed studies. But Grandjean says the EPA's advisory doesn't go far enough. He worries it could even create a false sense of security.
I mean, if you drink a lot of that water that is permissible, many Americans are actually likely to substantially increase their body burden of these compounds.
Last year, a coalition of scientists from around the world called for limits on C8 production altogether. Health officials in New Jersey are now suggesting that C8 levels should be 5 times lower than what EPA advises. In Vienna, West Virginia, Mayor Randy Rapp just wants to get the city's water to the EPA's acceptable level.
I just try to live by whatever the rules are. And when they tell us what our water quality has to be, that is the target that we shoot for, and that's the target that we will attain.
Meanwhile, Chemours today isn't using C8. It's using a chemical replacement. Unfortunately, studies indicate that the substitute could have some of the same ecological and health effects. In Vienna, West Virginia, I'm Glynis Board.
Just a quick update on the water in the town. The water in Vienna was improved to EPA standards by piping in water from a neighboring city and installing filters. We're going to take a quick break. Still to come, we'll hear what caused the river in Wheeling, West Virginia, to develop a dangerous neon green slime last summer. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Tilted in the wind again. Thought I'd take a little swim.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On this week's show, we're talking about the mighty Ohio, which has a polluted reputation, and it's not just industrial activity. Last summer, there was a bit of a fluke algae bloom along the Ohio River that stretched hundreds of miles. As Carol often reports, experts are warning that with climate change, the green slime will no doubt be back.
Ethan Wells has lived along the Ohio River for almost all of his 32 years. One day last August, he noticed blue-green algae growing along the riverbank near his home in Sistersville, an hour south of Wheeling, West Virginia.
I grew up on a farm around ponds and on the river, so I knew what it was.
Each time he looked, there was more of it.
As it progressed and it started to cover the river, it started looking kind of like a neon slime across the top of the river. And it was kind of eerie, in a way, to have the river alive like that.
A lot of people noticed.
The first time the Great Ohio River Swim is now canceled, all because of a problem with algae in our river.
Yeah, there's an advisory against recreational activities in the river.
That summer, more than 600 miles of toxic algae, known as cyanobacteria, was reported in West Virginia, Ohio, and all the way downriver in Illinois. Touching the stuff can be dangerous, causing rashes, lung, and kidney problems. Previous algae blooms around the world have been deadly. So states issued health warnings to avoid contact with a thick, stinky slime. This is the sound of the West Virginia American Water Treatment Plant in Huntington, one of 14 drinking water plants that found blooms in their intakes during last summer's outbreak. Laura Martin is a spokesperson for the company.
At a certain point, we actually enacted our contingency plan for the Huntington water system to switch over to an alternate source.
Since then, Martin says developing ways to deal with toxic algae is the plant's number one priority. During the 2015 bloom, water plants used chemicals to ensure the water was safe to send to customers. But
it's expensive.
That's Stanley States, who was water quality manager at the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority for decades. He's now an instructor at Texas A&M University and travels around the country teaching water utilities how to deal with disasters like cyanobacteria. He's not kidding about the cost. The water plant in Huntington spent $700,000 to deal with one outbreak on the Ohio. But without statewide or even regional regulations, all the plants can do is figure out ways to filter and treat the stuff.
The ultimate solution to controlling cyanobacterial blooms is going to be control of the release of excess nutrients into bodies of water.
Nutrients, especially phosphates, have been blamed for algae blooms in rivers and lakes all over the world. Phosphorus comes from sewage plants, lawns, and particularly agriculture. There are some 250,000 farms in the Ohio River watershed.
So if on farmland they use artificial fertilizers, they're supplemented with phosphates. If a farmer uses natural fertilizers, dung, that's loaded with phosphates. So rains wash these phosphates into rivers, to lakes.
When that phosphorus mixes with warm summer water, which is getting warmer as the climate changes, the combination creates the perfect recipe for cyanobacteria to bloom. On Lake Erie, toxic blooms have become something of a late summer ritual. The bloom in 2014 was so big that nearly 500,000 people lost their drinking water in Toledo, Ohio. Stanley State says the Ohio River could also continue to have blooms, in part because of all the locks and dams along the river that regulate flow.
It's not a free-flowing river. It's a series of lakes.
When the blooms took off on the Ohio River last summer, the state of Ohio was quick to respond.
A lot of what we were doing on the Ohio River, we learned from our situation up in Toledo.
Carl Gebhardt is Deputy Director of Water Resources with the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency.
We wanted to make sure that since they had never experienced this before, we were very quick in getting to them to make sure that they were sampling the water before it came into the intake and were implementing the proper treatment.
Ohio has become a key state to watch when it comes to treating toxic blooms. Farm runoff, in general, has been largely unregulated. But last year, in an effort to reduce nutrient runoff, Ohio passed a law limiting when farmers can apply manure to farm fields.
That was a big legislative achievement that the ag community to their credit bought into.
Ohio isn't going it alone. It's working with other states around the Great Lakes to reduce nutrient runoff. Their collaborative goal? Cut this type of pollution 40% over the next decade. Gebhardt says Ohio's new runoff regulations apply to farms all over the state, so it's also expected to keep pollution out of the Ohio River. So far, other river states haven't taken these kinds of steps, though.
Hopefully, West Virginia, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Indiana would look at that and say, okay, do we feel confident in our program that, you know, we're doing what we can do, or do we need to revisit that?
Gebhardt says state coordination could reduce pollution and prevent more toxic algae all along the river. And in the long run, that could save water treatment plants money and help ensure safe drinking water for the 5 million people who depend on the Ohio. In West Virginia, I'm Kara Lofton.
So, as Carol often just told us, last year's high temperatures combined with low water flow created an algae bloom. For our next story, we're going to take a look at why farming can also cause runoff issues. Nutrients found in plant fertilizer often isn't so nutritious for the river. With the push for agriculture to be a part of the development for the region, what can we do about it? One group thinks it has a solution for controlling nutrient and farm runoff, but as the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant found out, some say this program is really just a pay-to-pollute scheme.
Come on, girls!
There are about 55 cows and 10 pigs on Kenny Merrick's farm in eastern Ohio. It sits on a hillside above a creek, which leads to the Tuscarawas River, a tributary of the Ohio River.
I grew up next door milking cows at my grandma's place when I got out of college and bought the farm and started farming shortly thereafter.
Today they sell grass-fed beef and pasture-raised pork direct to customers. They feed the animals and pile their manure by a barn at the top of the hill. It's muddy.
And this was literally at times almost waist-deep mud in spots.
The manure and mud used to wash down the hill mucking up the stream, and Merrick didn't like it.
I needed to change something because we were losing the manure, would wash off every time it rained. We didn't have any way of containing it, and we didn't have enough space for the cows.
Wash off like this happens at farms all over the place, and it creates a serious pollution load. According to estimates, there are more than 250,000 farms in the Ohio River watershed. The Ohio is part of the larger Mississippi River Basin, and farm runoff from the Mississippi is estimated to contribute the majority of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, responsible for the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And there's not much to stop it. Agricultural runoff is largely unregulated. Merrick wanted to stop it on his farm. He wanted to lay a large concrete slab for the cows and manure at the top of the hill, secure the hillside, and fence the cattle away from the stream. The price tag? $20,000.
That's enormous costs.
But Merrick heard about something called a water credit trading program. That's where industrial polluters, like power plants, buy credits to meet their pollution limits. And the money goes to farmers to pay for projects like his. Jessica Fox is an environmental scientist with EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, which runs the program.
We started looking into it to try to test out if water quality trading could be an effective mechanism to protect America's waters and to meet company bottom lines.
That's one reason water trading credit programs have been popping up around the country. It might be more cost-effective for industries to pay for farm projects that clean up nitrogen and phosphorus pollution in a waterway than it would be to control an equal amount of it at their industrial plants. In the Ohio River watershed, there are limits on nitrogen, but not on phosphorus pollution. As these nutrients are increasingly blamed for toxic algae blooms in the river, that's expected to change. Currently, in the state of Ohio, environmental regulators are pushing for new phosphorus limits in the river. And that could make those credits, which cost $10 for a pound of nitrogen or phosphorus, more appealing. Jessica Fox has worked for more than a decade on this water pollution marketplace between Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. It's the first multi-state program like this in the country.
The first thing outright is that there's rigorous science and verification to say that nutrient reductions that we claim we are achieving and turning into credits is real and valid.
She's getting at one of the major reasons water trading credit programs have been called pay-to-pollute schemes. Scott Edwards is a director with the advocacy group Food and Water Watch.
We're trading accountability for unaccountability.
His group investigated trading credits in the Ohio River and the Chesapeake Bay. He says these programs have made it impossible to track exact pollution loads from power plants.
A power plant has to measure its discharges at the end of the pipe, report those results. I can tell you, or I used to be able to tell you, exactly how much pollution was coming out of a power plant and into a stream.
But Edwards says there's no way to test exactly how much pollution is being reduced by a manure pad or buffer strip on a farm.
That's a guess of what that buffer could do. No one ever is going to measure whether those 1,000 pounds ever were stopped at that farm from entering into a waterway. There's no monitoring going on.
Environmental regulators in New York rejected a water credit trading program in their state for similar reasons, the difficulty of verifying results on farms. Jessica Fox at the Ohio River Project says they use well-established modeling to estimate pollution reduction on farms, and they work with state regulators to verify annually that the projects are being maintained.
I go out there, I go in the farm field, I can see the projects where there used to be all kinds of sediment and manure running right into the river. There is no question that nutrient recovery is happening.
She acknowledges that they can't measure pollution reduction on a farm the way they can at the end of a pipe, but says that doesn't mean there aren't as many benefits.
One of the underlying promises of water quality trading is that you get pollinator benefits, you're sequestering carbon, you're working with local landowners, that a lot of times actually reduces more nutrients than at your wastewater treatment plant or power plant.
Just take Ohio beef producer Ken Merrick. Since controlling the mud from his farm, he's seen the stream come back to life.
My wife is actually catching fish out here last summer with the kids. My grandpa used to do that. I never caught anything. It's kind of cool to see the fish coming back into the area.
This is one of 30 farms that have benefited from the water trading program. They say they've prevented more than 100,000 pounds of nitrogen and phosphorus from getting into the Ohio River. And they have a new round of funding available, this time for forestry projects like tree plantings.
That was the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reporting in Ohio. Today we're taking a deeper look at the Ohio River thanks to a collaboration between West Virginia Public Broadcasting and the Allegheny Front with support from the Benedum Foundation for a special series called Headwaters. The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. Still to come, we'll take a closer look at a few different visions for the mighty Ohio's future. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This week, we've been talking a bit about the chemical industry in Appalachia, so we wanted to see if you could guess which town in Appalachia was named after a volatile chemical. Is it acetone, New York, formaldehyde, Alabama, or nitro, West Virginia? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So, what town in Appalachia is named after an explosive chemical? If you answered Nitro, West Virginia, well, you were correct. We spoke to Connie Shoemate, director of the Library of Concord University, to find out just how Nitro got its name.
Nitro is in Kanawha County. It was named in 1918 when the United States government conducted a high explosive plant there. At first called Red Wop, which is powder spelled backwards, but it quickly dropped that name because of the unpleasant ethnic connotation.
The federal government changed the town's name to Nitro, short for nitrocellulose, one of the chemicals that was made there. Nitrocellulose is one of the ingredients used to make smokeless powder for firearms and artillery ammunition and was in high demand during World War I.
Secretary of War Newton D. Baker gave it its present name. The project was started in January 1918 and the government poured $76 million into the area. By the time of World War I armistice, which was on November 11, 1919, which was the death blow to the town, its population rivaled that of Charleston.
Today, Nitro has a population of about 7,000 people. The town is located along the Kanawha River, a tributary of the Ohio. So now you know how Nitro, West Virginia got its name. If you know of another story about Nitro or ever heard of another town that you just wondered, how the heck did they come up with that name? Send us a tweet at @InAppalachia and we just might explore it inside Appalachia. So far, we've heard about some of the pollution sources that threaten the Ohio River. And we've also heard about what's being done to protect it as a source for clean drinking water. It takes innovation, creativity, and patience to make do with what you have. Folks along the Ohio River have dealt with their situation and found creative solutions to provide drinking water to millions of people. And it also takes a little grit to refuse to quit in the face of challenges. So as the economy tanks, jobs disappear, and businesses close, the second half of our show might come as no surprise. Julie Grant with the Allegheny Front reports on where the region stands now.
When you live in the Ohio River headwaters, hearing newscasts like this isn't too surprising.
Dozens of people are homeless after floodwaters destroyed their homes.
Or even hearing comments like this one from Pittsburgh triathlete Sarah Kaysen after a heavy rain.
I don't think anybody wants poop in their river. People are like, oh, it must just be rain runoff. Yes, it is. It is also raw, untreated sewage. It's gross. It's really gross.
Recent years have also brought news of chemical spills and algae blooms. But what if the river wasn't a problem to be dealt with and instead essential to the region's health and economic future? What might that look like? Let's go to this party to get an idea. It's at a restaurant in the heart of a busy urban riverfront park. This is a who's who in water. Researchers, technology geeks, water treatment experts, political and business leaders. Everyone's talking about how water fits into the region's economic development plans. But we're not in Pittsburgh. This is the first annual meeting of Cleveland's Water Alliance. Cleveland, of course, is home to the infamous Burning River and Lake Erie, known for toxic green algae in recent years. But Cleveland's ahead when it comes to putting a value on its water and how to leverage it to benefit the region. Alliance Executive Director Brian Stubbs says their efforts are already paying off.
Now we're starting to see the investment community pay attention. So what we're trying to do is to get private capital engaged in this space. No longer is it a lift of just the state or just the city or just a watershed group. We're now trying to figure out and having conversations with big money.
So look, tonight's about the organization.
Stubbs told Water Alliance members that their region has added more than 200 water technology jobs. They've got patents in the works. They're even launching a large-scale competition in cities around the Great Lakes to spur innovation in water technology. So if Cleveland's starting to bring in big money around its water, why can't the Ohio River watershed get similar action? Community planner Jerry Paytas with the consulting firm Fourth Economy looked into water's role in this region's economy.
I don't think it's top of mind. It's not something that people are thinking about. So in that regard, we're not really valuing what the water can mean to us long term.
The report he co-authored in 2011 found that water was already having a big economic impact. 3,000 firms were providing components, products, and services for the water industry, water supplies for agriculture, food processing, thermoelectric plants, and the energy industry supported more than $24 billion in the area's economy. The report also found that the region and the Ohio River headwaters has a unique opportunity to use its industrial strengths to grow a variety of water-related industries. But no one's coordinating a vision for the future of water in this region.
It's been referred to as the Wild West because there's no management of water.
Deborah Lang is in charge of special environmental projects at Carnegie Mellon University. After Paytas's report came out, she helped facilitate a committee of experts from Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio a few years ago. Their goal?
To start to get the headwaters region, which stretches all the way up into New York, prepared for the future of water.
But that effort largely stalled. There just wasn't much interest in a multi-state effort to create a vision for the watershed.
probably the biggest hurdle, and probably why we've been at this for 20 years, is that nobody wants another layer of regulation, approval, fees.
Lang says there are already plenty of groups and agencies working on water issues in the Headwaters region. On the state level, environmental agencies approve water withdrawals and regulate pollution.
So the Department of Environmental Protection might be granting permits.
There's the U.S. Army Corps.
The Corps of Engineers is monitoring water flow and managing their locks and dams.
There's a group called RAIN.
RAIN is collecting real-time water quality data.
And then there's ORSANCO.
Their compact has them worry about water quality in the entire Ohio River Basin. There's no coordination of all of that. So we have a lot of pieces of the puzzle that are working. We're close. But we just kind of need that little push to begin to coordinate.
This isn't a new concept. Other watersheds have been doing it for decades. There's the Great Lakes Compact, which spells out who can take water and how much. The Susquehanna River, the Delaware River, the Chesapeake Bay all have multi-state commissions with planning authority, but not the Ohio River. And climate change could make that even more important. As some areas become increasingly parched, the Ohio Headwaters region is expected to see bigger rainfalls and more water.
Since we're a water-rich area, a water-poor area could, in essence, stick a straw into the water there at the point and begin extracting water.
There's no one lining up to suck up the Ohio River, at least not right now, but Lang says the region should be preparing. Community planner Jerry Paytas agrees, and for him, it's about the economy. Just look at tech companies like Google and Facebook. When they're recruiting new employees to the region, they need quality drinking water and a river clean enough for recreation.
If we don't manage the water withdrawals, if we don't manage the water quality, is going to be very difficult to add people or grow the economy. So it may not be so much of an economic driver, but it surely will become an economic break.
Paytas' 2011 report did not recommend a new water organization, but it did call for a multi-state task force or council to coordinate planning of the region's water resources. And as thirst for water grows around the world, he says the need for this is becoming increasingly important.
That was the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reporting. Some developers are looking for new ways to use the mighty Ohio to help the economy. Does the polluted legacy leave room for river recreation? Things like kayaking, fishing, and swimming. Well, Glenn Spohr takes a look at how the region can balance these two seemingly opposite uses.
Business has been picking up in recent years for Tim Redinger. He owns a bait shop in Bridgewater, just north of Pittsburgh, along the Ohio River.
I want to show you something. Can you see that right there?
With a fishing rod in one hand, Redinger points from the bank to a nearby eddy in the river.
Those are baby shad, probably not a couple months old.
You can see a few industrial sites from Redinger's fishing spot, but he says it's nothing like it used to be when he was a kid 50 years ago.
That mountainside over there was orange at night. I mean, orange from all the blast furnaces and stuff rolling. Hey, it was dump city. Back then, no one cared.
But over time, many mills closed down, and the Clean Water Act limited pollution from those that remained. Redinger remembers it was more than a decade ago when the shad started showing up.
It tells you how good the water is. Say boo to them, they fall over dead. They will not live in contaminated water, anything whatsoever. And that, look at that, they're all through here.
The decline of industry was pretty devastating to the region's economy. Redinger says, the flip side though, more people are hanging out on the river here, and that's true in Pittsburgh too.
Scott Carroll, you're 8 strokes out. Rocky Valley is 2. Mark, you're through.
This is sound from the head of the Ohio, a fall regatta in Pittsburgh. It's just one of the many recreational activities on the river these days.
We've been working to make the riverfront accessible to everyone and really exciting cultural places for the city.
Nina Chase is an urban designer with a nonprofit called Riverlife. They've overseen development of a system of parks and trails along the riverfronts in Pittsburgh, but it hasn't been cheap. Chase says the $130 million spent is worth it.
That $130 million of investment has actually triggered $4.1 billion in investment in riverfront and adjacent riverfront development projects downtown.
Now Riverlife is trying to bring Pittsburgh's recreational vision downstream to smaller communities. They recently received a grant from the Benedum Foundation, which, by the way, also funded this series of radio stories. Chase says Riverlife is trying to encourage a culture of recreation all along the Ohio River. And they aren't alone. Tom Way has been trying to lead his downstream city of Steubenville, Ohio, in this same direction. Standing by the river, Way says many towns like his are still struggling economically from the downturn in the steel and coal industries. They're trying to figure out what's next.
As the communities search for identities, there's opportunity for growth and direction in areas of outdoor recreation, art, food diversity, cultural diversity.
A few years ago, he founded the Urban Frontier Organization to promote this type of creative economic development in the Upper Ohio Valley. His goal is to reactivate forgotten or neglected assets, including the river itself. One thing he's pushing, water sports.
We're working on a project now to bring non-motorized watercraft rentals and adaptive paddling to the region.
Now, by adaptive paddling, he means kayaks, canoes, and rafts. Cheap ways to get people enjoying the river. And there are other projects like this along the Ohio River. But can recreation and tourism really be an economic driver? There is not a lot of research on the economic impacts of river recreation in the Ohio Valley. But further downstream, on the Mississippi River in Iowa, nature-based recreation is one of the state's largest industries. Rivergoers spend $1.5 billion a year there. But the Ohio River still has the stigma as one of the dirtiest waterways in the country. And more towns are interested in rebuilding it around industry, not recreation. Shell is building a new ethane cracker in Beaver, Pennsylvania, and two other cracker plants are being considered in the region. New spin-off industries are already gearing up. Riverlife's Nina Chase says, just as in Pittsburgh, though, there's room on the river for industry and recreation. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
You have to be creative with land use and points of access that you can have both and you can have them work well.
Back on the river in Bridgewater, PA, bait shop owner Tim Redinger is banking on it. He's only a few miles downstream from where Shell's ethane cracker is being constructed. But when he looks at the baby shad in the water, he smiles at how clean the water has become.
That's a great sign. You see that? Life is good.
That was Glynis Ford, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's energy and environment reporter. With the recent uptick in the development of Appalachia's natural gas and the popularity of rebuilding America's manufacturing sector, there's a lot of hope right now along the Ohio River that industry is going to make a comeback. Patrick Ford of Chester, West Virginia, works to redevelop land for future industrial sites. Here's how he explains a vision for the northern panhandle of West Virginia.
5 years ago, what was here, just the remnant and the skeleton of an 80,000 square foot building in disrepair, and it was just vacant, graffiti, weeds, glass, and the community lived in the shadow of this for 30 years. We kept being overlooked for economic development decisions that were being made by national and international companies to want to locate in the northern panhandle, because we simply did not have sites to meet the demand that was emerging in the area. And all of the developable land just happened to be all of these abandoned mills. And you can't drive 10 miles in the Ohio River Valley without seeing an abandoned mill. We picked the toughest of all of them in the Ohio River Valley. I don't know why we did that. Maybe I'm not that smart. But what I am is I believe in the future of this area. The building has been completely torn down. We went down and remediated the lead from the soil, so now you're walking on fresh soil here. The lead shards from the pottery that didn't make it to the store was literally thrown over the fence for decades, generations. So we had to remediate all of those lead shards from the riverbank. We were also responsible for the river, so we actually were out there dredging the lead out of the river. You just go back as early as 10 years ago, there were no shovels in the ground in the Ohio River. Drive today from Chester all the way down to beach bottom, you're going to see buildings being erected, shovels in the ground, and earth-moving equipment everywhere.
That was Patrick Ford of Chester, West Virginia, sharing his vision of revitalizing old buildings to ready them for new businesses. We've covered a lot of issues about water in the Ohio Valley region of Appalachia, but there's another issue down in Monick, the woods of southern West Virginia, that we'll be reporting on in an upcoming episode of Inside Appalachia. Before I go, I wanted to share a sneak peek of what's coming up in February, an episode that explores the dangers of aging water systems in the coal fields. Jessica Griffith was one of the people who we spoke to. You may remember her from a previous episode of our show when we asked people what they were hoping and fearing from a Trump presidency. While I was at the Griffiths' home in Wyoming County, Jessica shared her family's ongoing struggles to get clean drinking water.
Most days, you know, you never know what you're going to wake up to. Some days there might be a little bit of water enough for you to wash a couple dishes. Some days you might not have anything at all.
We'll explore what residents in southern West Virginia and in eastern Kentucky are facing as they try to upgrade these aging water systems in the coal fields. That show's coming up in February. You can subscribe to the Inside Appalachia podcast on iTunes, Downcast, WV Public, or wherever you get your podcasts, and it'll come right to your phone, computer, or electronic device. Oh, and we wanted to say a big thank you to Xander Alloy. He's been our audio mixer for the past year, and sadly, he's moving this week. He's headed to Detroit, Michigan to start a new job as a professional blacksmith. For real. Xander, good luck up in Michigan, and let us know how the drinking water situation is up there, all right? To all my Appalachian listeners, near and far, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We'll see you next week. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Marisa Anderson, Zach Bird, and Ben Townsend. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special. From their album Songs of a Tradition, Catherine Moore was our editor this week. Roxy Todd helped to produce the show. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
My name is Kaya Cater, and I'm a musician. I recently graduated from Davis and Elkins College, which is in Elkins, West Virginia. And then a couple months later, I had the privilege of being on Mountain Stage with Larry Gross. Shows like A Change of Tune and Inside Appalachia have not only helped me discover more music and artists that I love, but also get to know what's happening in other counties within the state. Especially after this year's election, I'm looking forward to more coverage about what a Trump presidency will mean for Appalachia. That's why the stories I hear on West Virginia Public Broadcasting are like a box of chocolates. Some of them are sweet, some have different flavors of opinion, but all of them are done with a wealth of journalistic integrity that really matters to me. So rise with me to meet this chocolate challenge. Order a box of Hall's chocolate, call 1-800-RADIO-87 or go to wvpublic.org. Thanks so much. Bye.